iHeart Podcasts.
Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
So I was looking up a map of the Appalachian Trail and trying to remind myself of exactly where it goes. And did you know the Appalachian Trail might actually expand into Morocco of all places?
How is that even possible?
Well, I thought this sounded ridiculous too, but it's actually pretty cool. So let me explain this. So there's this visionary. His name is Dick Anderson. And this was according to NPR, but he has this idea to turn the AT into this international trail.
I mean, I guess I can see that from like a branding perspective, but why would you do that?
You're going to remember this from your school age, Mango. You remember the word Pangea?
Uh-huh.
When all of the continents were together?
I miss it.
So they were connected some 200 million years ago. And so he noticed that when the landmass broke up, so did this giant mountain range. And, you know, now there are pieces of the range that are in Morocco and Greenland, Norway, Spain, a bunch of other countries. So the Appalachians kind of continue around the world. And you look at what other countries are doing. Canada's already designated 1,800 miles from Maine to Newfoundland. And the British Geological Survey has done the same thing with this 96-mile portion of a trail that runs through the UK.
Oh, wow.
But all this excitement over the International Appalachian Trail, it made us want to take a closer look at how the original Appalachian Trail got its start. Why did some people start hiking the AT in the first place? What are some of the crazy stories from those early hikes? And what's the real reason park rangers don't want people hiking naked? Because believe it or not, there is a good one. So let's dig in. Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Hatticketer. And on the other side of the soundproof glass, steamrolling his way through a tub of Rocky Road. It is Rocky Road,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, definitely Rocky Road.
Rocky Road ice cream. That's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil. Oh, I get it. Rocky Road. How stupid am I? Well, anyway, believe it or not, Tristan's actually trying to pass this off as part of his training for hiking the Appalachian Trail. I don't know if he's going to hike the whole thing or what, but he claims there's a tradition that began around the 1980s where hikers would down a ton of ice cream. I'm just not so sure about this though, Mango.
It actually is a real thing. It's called
really?
A half-gallon challenge. And
gross.
Hundreds of AT hikers take it on every single year. And Tristan is getting a little ahead of himself, though, as he always does. The challenge is something hikers do once they reach the official halfway point of the trek.
Okay.
It's actually in this town called Pine Grove Furnace in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is to celebrate the milestone by wolfing down a half gallon of ice cream in under an hour. There's like a time limit on it. There's actually this general store there that's been hosting the event for about 40 years now. And the owner says that the all-time record for a half-gallon challenge is under 5 minutes.
Oh, gross. That is, well, we'll have to put our friend Yasser, the competitive eater, up to the challenge to see if he can beat that. But that sounds disgusting. And I'm curious, do the challengers get anything for pulling this off besides brain freeze, of course?
I mean, you get bragging rights, of course, but
not worth it.
There are these little prizes. They call them victory spoons, and it's basically one of those little wooden spoons that comes with an ice cream cup,
mm-hmm.
except this one has the words "member of the half-gallon club" printed on it.
Oh, what a fancy prize. I mean, I actually love hearing about all the Appalachian Trail traditions that have sprung up over the years because, you know, at 2,200 miles, the trail really is its own little world. And at this point, it feels like the trail's unique social life is really as much of a draw as the beautiful scenery or the sense of the challenge. And you know, if you think about it, there's this entire community spread across 14 different states. And now, as we've learned, in Morocco as well, maybe one day. But
mm-hmm.
the only thing that ties them together is that pull they feel toward this trail. So you've got this team of trail maintenance volunteers who keep the route clear and safe for hikers and supportive residents along the way in these adjacent towns. And they come in to cheer on the hikers or give them food or often even a place to crash for the night. And then there are the hikers themselves. And so they'll often meet as strangers from all walks of life, but you know, a few shared hardships a couple thousand miles later, and they form these lifelong friendships.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few friends who've done this, and there's clearly no question that hiking the AT is this life-changing experience for tons of people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you hear that over and over. And so today we thought we'd take a closer look at why that is. So we'll talk about how the trail got its start, about some of the most notable folks who've hiked it. also dig a little bit deeper into life on the trail and check out a few of the clever ways that intrepid hikers have found to keep things interesting. So there's a lot to talk about, but where do you want to start, Mango?
Well, how about running through some quick stats about the AT, just for those who aren't familiar with it? So for starters, the AT is the longest hiking-only footpath, not just in the U.S., but in the entire world. Its official length fluctuates every year. It's because miles are added or removed as they perform various upgrades and repairs along the passes. Mm-hmm. But in general, the trail runs just under 2,200 miles. It stretches from Springer Mountain in Georgia all the way up to Mount Katahdin in Maine. And along the way, the trail cuts through the mountainous regions of 12 other states. And while millions of day hikers visit some portion of the trail every year, the AT is probably most famous for its so-called 2,000 Milers Club. And these are those super determined folks who cover the trail's entire length from one end to the other. And there are a bunch of different ways you can do this. You can take the trail in segments over the course of multiple years. They're called segment hikers, the people who do this.
Mm-hmm.
You can hike straight through, and that often takes 5 to 7 months. Those people are called through hikers. Or you can complete half the trail in one direction before switching to the opposite end to complete the other half of the trail later that year. And those are called flip-flop hikers. But, you know, no matter how you do it, hiking the AT is this grueling challenge. And it takes about 5 million footsteps if you had a pedometer on to complete.
Wow. I mean, that is just so long. 2,000 miles. I'm not sure if I've actually walked that long in my entire life. I'm sure I have. But that is so long. And obviously, it's why so few people make it. I was actually just looking at the stats from the AT Conservancy, and it looks like about 4,200 people have attempted the thru-hike trail over the past 12 months. Yet of those more than 4,000 people, only 49 people actually completed it.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, if you count from when the trail was created back in 1937 all the way to today, only around 19,000 hike completions have ever been recorded. You think about the number of people that have been out there over the years. So it's a pretty elite club to be part of.
Definitely. But I do want to talk a little bit about how the trail came to be in the first place. So you already mentioned the AT was officially completed in 1937, but the initial idea for the trail actually dates back to 1900. And that was the year this man named Benton McKay graduated from Harvard. And he hiked into the Green Mountains of Vermont to celebrate. And as the story goes, McKay climbed to this tree atop of Stratton Mountain, and he saw this gorgeous view there. And it just gave him this idea for a dedicated trail following the Appalachian Mountains all the way from Maine to Georgia. And 21 years later, McKay was an established land use planner. And that's when he finally took his first steps to making his dream a reality. He published this article in an architectural journal, and it outlined his vision for a nature trail that anyone on the East Coast could escape to as needed, or as he put it, a place to walk, to see, and to see what you see.
So if McKay's plan was published in 1921, but it didn't open for another 16 years?
Yeah, so McKay was a great idea man, but he kind of lacked follow-through.
Yeah.
And thankfully, there was this maritime lawyer. His name was Myron Avery, and he heard about the project, and he was really the one who pushed it along. So he started mapping the trail's route on his own. He took this rolling measuring wheel, and he went mile after mile, just taking notes for future guidebooks.
Wow.
And he started the process in 1920, and then about 10 years into the process, he started organizing these crews of volunteers to build the whole thing.
So it took him a full decade to map out the trail.
It actually took him 16 years.
Wow.
He kept mapping even as construction had started, and he didn't finish the project until 1936, which is 1 year before the final portion of the trail was cleared. The task was probably worth it, though, in the long run, because technically it made Avery the first person to walk the entire AT, at least as a segment hiker.
Huh. So actually, I was looking at the first through hiker, and the world would have to wait until 1948 for that to happen. So you think about the timing of this. You know, you'd had World War II that had curtailed most people's interest in the trail for the better part of its first decade or so of existence. But then once the war was over and servicemen were returning home, the AT lured a new batch of challengers. Now, among them was a guy named Earl Schaefer. He was a 29-year-old World War II veteran. He was from Yorkshire, Pennsylvania. He'd read about the trail in this Outdoor Living magazine, and Schaefer decided to thru-hike the AT because it was a way, as he said, to walk the Army out of his system.
Huh.
So he set out from Georgia on April 4th, and he made it to the end of the trail in Maine just 124 days later. Now, if you do the math on this, this means he averaged about 16 and a half miles a day. That
wow.
is so long. Now, along the way, Schaefer kept a journal to document his thoughts and to really serve as proof that he had truly done what he claimed. And what's interesting is that he sort of unintentionally kicked off a new literary genre. Today, the internet is full of these online hiking sites that catalog entries from people's Appalachian Trail journals. And occasionally, these accounts even make their way onto the store's shelves, as they do. You know, if you think about the most famous one, probably Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods.
Yeah, I mean, that is cool that he kicked off this genre. But what's weird is that Schaefer's legacy is even bigger than that. So he hiked the trail twice more in his lifetime. The second time was in 1965, and then again he did it in 1998 at the age of 79.
Wow.
And that second time, Schaefer hiked from Maine to Georgia, which actually made him the first person to thru-hike in both directions.
That is amazing that he did this at 79, and it should offer some encouragement to Tristan. He's in his 70s, right?
Right, I think so.
So he can
he has
still
time
do
to do it both ways.
He's got time. Well, I mean, even though Earl Schaefer passed away in 2002, you'll be happy to know that before his death, he donated both the backpack and the boots that he wore on that 1948 hike to the Smithsonian.
Oh, good.
So you can go see these. And keep in mind that Schaefer wore the same pair of boots for all 2,000 miles of his trip that year. I can't even imagine how torn up these things were. And he'd often walk days without socks for some reason. And so rather than replace the boots a few times along the way, you know, like most hikers do, Schaefer would simply patch them up himself, or he had them resold in towns along his route. And, you know, as you can imagine, these things were very much worse for the wear. In fact, one of the museum curators once confessed, quote, "The boots are smelly, and those cabinets are opened as little as possible."
Schaefer was the first man to thru-hike the AT, but do you know much about the first woman to do this?
I do, and this was a really interesting read. That was Emma Gatewood, or Grandma Gatewood, as she later became known. Now, her story is a pretty amazing one. She was the mother of 11 children and something like 23 grandchildren, and after 30 years of being in an abusive marriage, she divorced her husband and started her life all over. And it was sometime in the 1950s she read this Nat Geo article about the Appalachian Trail and how Earl Schaefer was the first man to thru-hike it. And she told her daughter, quote, "If those men can do it, I can do it." So then in 1955, she proved she was right by walking the entire trail. It only took her 146 days.
Wow.
Now, this was impressive for all kinds of reasons. For one thing, Gatewood was 67 years old when she completed her hike, and she did the whole thing by herself without any support. I mean, it's just unbelievable. In fact, she was kind of a pioneer of what we call ultralight hiking today. Hmm. Gatewood wore a pair of KED sneakers the entire trip. She traveled without the usual staples, like a sleeping bag, a tent, or even a compass.
What?
I mean, some of this just seems way too crazy to attempt it. She did carry an umbrella with her, which she used to chase off a black bear at one point, apparently.
Sure.
But that was pretty much the extent of her quote-unquote luxuries, as you might see them. In fact, Grandma Gatewood gave this great quote to Sports Illustrated, so I'll just read this. Here's what she said. "I thought it would be a nice lark. It wasn't. There were terrible blowdowns, burnt over areas that were never remarked, gravel, sand washouts, weeds and brush to your neck. And most of the shelters were blown down, burned down, or so filthy I chose to sleep out of doors. This is no trail. This is a nightmare."
I mean, of course it's a nightmare. She's using an umbrella to chase away bears.
Yeah. I think she could have made it a little bit easier on herself, and we still would have been impressed.
I know. It really is impressive. But, you know, I did set you off there a little bit. I do want to point out that Emma Gatewood was not the first woman to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail.
You let me tell this whole story? No way.
Yeah. She was the first person to thru-hike it solo, though.
Okay. Yeah. Why everything I read said that Gatewood holds the title.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably the biggest misconception about the trail's history. You know, even Grandma Gatewood thought she was the first woman to do this, but in reality, a woman named Mildred Norman beat her to it 3 years earlier, though her accomplishment largely went unnoticed.
I mean, can you imagine what a bummer that was? I'm sure she didn't just do it for that recognition, but for Grandma Gatewood to get to the end and be like, yes, I'm the first, and then find out it's Mildred. But I'm curious, why is this? I mean, it was huge news when Gatewood finished her hike, so why had Mildred Norman been overlooked for so long for doing the same thing first?
I mean, it's hard to say for certain, but the likeliest explanation is it's because she didn't complete it alone. She actually traveled the whole way with a companion who was a male companion who was not her husband.
Oh, that last part's probably key there.
Yeah.
It was not her husband. I mean, that sounds a lot less scandalous than it probably was in the 1950s.
Yeah.
But is that it? I mean, is that why her name isn't in more history books?
I think so. I mean, it's also amazing that, like, Mildred really didn't mind being slighted. So on her hike in 1952, she had this life-changing vision. She was sitting on a hill overlooking New England, and she renamed herself Peace Pilgrim. And then she set out on this cross-country activism walking tour. It lasted the next 23 years and took her over 25,000 miles.
Huh. Well, I'm glad she got something out of the experience. And, you know, since we're on the subject of AT record holders, I do want to tell you a little bit about Joe McConaughey. So last year, he broke the all-time speed record for a through hike, and you won't believe how fast he did it.
So I definitely want to hear the details about this, but first, let's take a quick break.
You're listening to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking about what it's like to hike the Appalachian Trail. All right, Mango, so this isn't something I thought of before, but apparently there's this whole sub-community of people who try to hike the entire AT as fast as they possibly can, you know, because leisurely hiking 2,200 miles isn't challenging enough, I guess. And so this speed hiking practice caught on in the early 90s, and ever since then, it's been this constant tug-of-war of records. And I say records, plural, because there are actually separate records depending on whether you do a supported or a self-supported run. So on a supported run, the hiker has a companion or a crew that kind of shadows them along the trail. They might provide water or food or fresh supplies, even moral support, which of course is incredibly helpful on such a long hike. And then on the flip side, a self-supported run means the hiker takes care of all these things themselves. So every 5 days or so, the hiker would have to leave the trail and then head into a nearby town to restock on food supplies.
I mean, that might sound like a burden, but those self-supported runs are really the kind that most regular hikers make since, you know, there's only so much weight you can carry in a backpack.
Yeah.
And thankfully, restocking actually isn't that difficult because the AT intersects with the road every 4 miles on average.
Huh.
Which is way more than I'd expected.
Definitely.
Like, I wouldn't have guessed that the trail brought you into civilization that often, but it obviously always hasn't been that way.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of surprising, but even with stores and towns just a few miles off the trail, that's still more time than some speed hikers want to spend. But the record holder I want to talk about today is a self-supported hiker. His name, as I mentioned, is Joe McConaughey, and when he broke the thru-hike speed record last August, he was just 26 years old.
Huh.
But get this, he averaged 48 miles per day for most of his run.
What?
And finished, when he finished this thing, it was with a stunning 110.8-mile push over the course of the last 37 sleepless hours. I mean,
wow.
That sounds like a real nightmare to me. The guy is just a machine. And it was that final push that helped him just destroy the previous record by a full 9 days.
Huh.
In fact, he even beat the current supported record by 10 hours.
Oh, wow.
And in the end, McConaughey hiked the entire Appalachian Trail in the fastest time ever reported, 45 days, 12 hours, and 15 minutes.
Wait, so he basically hiked the whole Appalachian Trail in like a month and a half? I can't even imagine that.
It's unbelievable. I mean, after setting up camp for the night, McConaughey says he ate like 9 s'mores. And then the next morning, he and his girlfriend drove straight to a diner where he ordered the Hungry Person Special, and he ate half of his girlfriend's breakfast for good measure. I mean, I just can't even imagine what this guy felt like at the end of this thing.
I know. Being up for 37 hours, you know, is itself difficult for some people.
Yeah.
And then to be running the whole time just seems insane and over mountains.
Yeah. Well, Gabe pointed me to this interview in Runner's World where he talked about some of the struggles he faced along the way, and so I thought I'd just read a quick excerpt from it. It was a constant battle, he says, describing sprained ankles, extreme chafing, wasp stings, painful blisters, a sore on his lower back, swollen quads, and a case of rhabdomyolysis, which is when muscle tissue breaks down and releases damaging protein into the blood. And it can be very dangerous, actually.
Sounds rough.
Easy days on the AT were few and far between. But there is one thing that made those rough days a little bit more bearable for Joe, and that's something that hikers refer to as trail magic. Have you ever heard of trail magic?
Yeah, I've read a little bit about it. It's like those small acts of kindness from strangers, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Like you'll be hiking along, suddenly you'll find like a cooler full of sodas that someone's left as a pick-me-up for any hikers who are going by.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, people who produce this trail magic, they're known as trail angels.
So I've got to say, this bothers me a little because I feel like trail magic should be produced by trail magicians, but
that would make sense. But trail angels, I don't know, that feels pretty sweet. But whatever you want to call them, these are mostly local residents who live near the trail and kind of take it upon themselves to lift the hiker's spirits with these small and unexpected forms of aid. So, you know, for instance, Joe McConaughey met a trail angel in Vermont who cooked him a delicious omelet one morning. So I guess you could call this person an omelet angel. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a day hiker once gave him some extra batteries so Joe could power his headlamp and keep running through the night. So it can really be anything, a ride into town or back to the trail, a hot shower, a night on a couch, some spare food, Band-Aids, whatever it might be. Trail magic definitely comes in many forms, but all of these are very much appreciated by these hikers.
Yeah, so I was reading about this one legendary trail angel. His name's Jim Tabor, and he lives near a section of the trail in rural Pennsylvania. And for the past few years, he's been placing hundreds of these hand-carved wooden spoons all along the route. And the spoons obviously come in handy for any hiker who needs one, but maybe more importantly, they provide this little emotional boost because word of the spoons have spread all through the hiking community. And there's this legend now that if you're lucky enough to find one of Jim's spoons, then you're supposedly, like, guaranteed to finish your through hike.
I mean, these are the kinds of stories that I love about the Appalachian Trail. It's so cool. And that he found this one way that he could contribute is pretty neat. It's that sense of community and there's all this shared lore and in-jokes that most people outside the bubble have no idea about.
Yeah, so I know what you mean, but I heard one thru-hiker describe the AT community as kind of a mobile small town and one that steadily moves north as the weeks go by. And one thing that helps promote that sense of connectedness is the use of trail names. And we haven't really talked about this yet, but the majority of those 2,000 milers shed their identity while they're on the trail, and they take on a new one in the form of a trail name. And this can be helpful in a few different ways. So for one thing, it helps strengthen the feeling that you've really stepped away from the modern world and are engaged in something totally different from your normal day-to-day life. I mean, you literally aren't the same person on the trail as you are at home. But another way trail names are helpful is that they help you keep track of your fellow hikers. Like, you might run into 10 Daves or 15 Emilies on the trail, and they'd all start to blur together. But you'll probably only meet one Brother Buzz or Snotrag in your lifetime. So connecting that face with the name, it just ends up being a whole lot easier.
Man, somebody already took Snotrag? Are those made-up names or are those real?
No, they're actually real names, but I don't know the stories behind those. But I did come across this one hiker's account of trail names and how important they are to the community. And she gave this great example. Her name's Hannah Storrs. She wrote about it on this website called The Trek, and I'm going to read from her story. Quote, "The stories that build up around names can be really great and travel up and down the trail faster than the person can walk. For instance, we heard about Bear Spray probably a week before we met him. We got his name from when he was staying at the top of the Georgia hostel and was trying to get something from inside his bag. He had a bottle of Bear Spray and something caught on the safety and released it. He accidentally sprayed Bear Spray all over the top floor of the hostel. Oof. They had to close the whole floor and he had to be washed up and aided. When everyone else at the hostel heard what happened, they dubbed him Bear Spray instantly. The story and the name circulated pretty quickly, and because it was so good, when Sean and I finally met him, it was like meeting an old friend. We were already fond of him, and it was a great conversation starter."
Oh, that's pretty cool. And, you know, it reminds me of these accounts you read from ancient times, or even like the Middle Ages, where travelers on a road would introduce themselves with this whole spiel about their family and lineage and their life story. And more often than not, a perfect stranger would recognize who the person was just because they'd heard some story of that family.
Exactly. And this practice of using trail names actually goes way back. Like that guy, Earl Schaefer, the first person to thru-hike the AT, he called himself the crazy one because no one thought he'd actually be able to make the whole trail. And then there's Mildred Norman, who became Peace Pilgrim. Emma Gatewood was Grandma Gatewood. So the names have actually been there from the start. But they didn't catch on until the 80s. And so according to the Conservancy's records, less than 10% of hikers reported using a trail name in 1983. But by 1987, more than 50% of the hikers were using them. And by 1999, 96% of all segment hikers had adopted the tradition too.
Well, while we're on that subject of life on the trail, I want to talk about something that every AT hiker comes to rely on. And that's the white blaze system that's used to guide hikers along the full length of the trail. So as you might imagine, the woods and the mountains start to look the same after a few hundred miles.
Sure.
And so it can be all too easy to wander off the course onto one of these many unconnected trails because there are obviously a ton of them. And they run adjacent to the Appalachian Trail. And so to prevent this, there's this army of trail maintenance volunteers that have marked the way with approximately 165,000 white blazes. Now, these are these 2-inch by 6-inch vertical rectangles. They're painted on white rocks, trees, and signposts all along the Appalachian Trail.
I mean, can you imagine how much upkeep that takes? I'm guessing the glazes must get worn away over time, and you probably need someone to repaint them constantly, right?
It's a staggering amount of work when you read about this, especially when you consider that the white blazes aren't the only ones that are out there. There are also blue blazes, which are used to mark many of the trails that branch off from the Appalachian Trail but aren't technically part of it. So if you follow a blue blaze trail, it'll likely take you to maybe like a beautiful view or a water source or a campground or, you know, something else that's just off the beaten path, but maybe worth a look to most leisurely hikers. But the only catch is that most of these blue blaze trails are dead ends, so you do have to double back once you reach the end of one.
I do love the idea of that there are these surprises just waiting for you at the end of these blue blazes.
Yeah.
It's really kind of magical. You know, Gabe was telling me about this, too, and he almost likened it to a video game where, you know, it's almost like a side quest where it's not your main goal, but they're fun and rewarding if you have the time for it.
Yeah, I mean, that analogy for hiking the Appalachian Trail being like a video game, I mean, it kind of feels far removed from the experience, but you could think of it like that. And actually, aside from the physical white and blue markers, there are also all of these more conceptual kinds. For example, yellow blazing is slang for walking, hitchhiking, or driving the highways that run alongside the AT. I mean, the idea is that the yellow blazes are, they're kind of like the yellow dashes that run down the center of the highway.
So, I mean, I think that's kind of funny, but I'm guessing it's a little derogatory, right? Like, hikers probably frown upon those yellow blazers?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the yellow blazing is pretty much a shortcut, so hiking purists kind of turn their noses up at it. And the same goes for aqua blazing. I'm sure you can guess what this one is, but this is when you're using maybe kayaks or rafts or boats or something to skip a part of the trail rather than cars.
I love that there's this, like, whole rainbow of conceptual blazes. Like, are there any others?
Yeah, I'm not done yet. There's, you're probably going to guess what this one is, but there's brown blazing, which refers to a hiker going off the trail to relieve themselves. It's, you know, often used to refer to a hiker who's dealing with some stomach issues,
sure.
I guess. There's also pink blazing, which is used to describe hikers who have hooked up on the trail and started traveling together.
For love?
That's real love. And then there's green blazing, which is when a hiker smokes pot on the trail. And lastly, there is gold or platinum blazing, which is in reference to those big spending hikers who have all the fanciest gear and tend to live it up whenever they're headed into town.
Well, now that we've color-coded the trail for everyone, what do you say we take a look at the state of the AT today? But first, we should take a quick break. Welcome back to Part-Time Genius, where we're talking about the Appalachian Trail. So, Will, one of the ways the AT has changed over the years is that it's a lot more crowded than it used to be. And public awareness of the trail has grown over the years, and that's largely thanks to some books. The first was Ed Garvey's 1971 hit. It was called Appalachian Hiker, Adventure of a Lifetime. The book boosted public awareness of the AT so much that nearly 800 people went on to complete the trail in the 1970s. And just to give you an idea of just how big a boost that was, in the 33 years between 1936 and 1969, only 59 completions had been logged in total.
Wow, that is a huge increase. And I would have to imagine there would be a similar, if not a bigger, rise when Bill Bryson released A Walk in the Woods. We talked about that earlier, but that was in the, I guess, the late 90s, right?
Yeah, and then again in 2015 when the movie came out, it's actually called the Bryson Bump in his honor.
Huh.
You know, the increase in hikers has also led to some negative environmental impact on the trail. There's this species of butterfly called the Katahdin butterfly, and they used to be all over the trail's terminus in Maine. But now the butterfly is considered endangered, and that's because so many people have sort of trampled through the meadows where the butterflies once thrived.
Yeah, and I've also read about how the influx of visitors has kind of lowered the bar in terms of trail etiquette. Like, you know, you read these reports of hikers not picking up after themselves, even doing reckless stuff like chucking dead batteries into their campfires. And it just, it's so irritating when you hear that people do this. I don't know why people would do this. And then even some of the less serious hiking groups that kind of devolve into these roving frat parties where everybody does way more drinking than they do hiking. And you want people to have a good time. But at the same time, this kind of stuff tends to dampen that experience for those who are actually trying to hike the entire trail.
I mean, that's definitely true, but there is a bright side to sort of this uptick in exposure for the AT.
And what would you say that is?
So the demographics of who hikes the trail are actually beginning to broaden. So in the trail's first few decades, female hikers only accounted for about 15% of hikers who completed the AT. But in recent years, that's actually doubled to nearly 30%. And while the vast majority of 2,000 milers continue to be white, the number of people of color who hike the trail is also on the rise. You might have seen this, but there's a story of this woman, Rahawa Hale. And in 2016, she became one of the first few black women to ever thru-hike the AT. And one of the reasons she wanted to do it was just to inspire more people of color to head for the trail. And apparently it was really a struggle for her to even find resources for black hikers. Like, she said that when she Googled black hikers, the first thing that pops up is a listing for a pair of black Timberland boots. But, you know, by documenting her journey for others to read about, Rahawa really hopes to change all that legacy.
Well, on that more optimistic note, why don't we do today's Fact Off a little bit differently? And let's just reel off some tips for any listeners who might be thinking of tackling the AT themselves. What do you think?
I'm down with that.
All right, well, the first piece of advice I want to give is to know which way you plan to go. How smart is that advice? And that
really
might
great.
Seem pretty obvious, but choosing whether to hike southbound, or as people refer to it as SOBO, or northbound, NOBO, is actually a really important decision because it also dictates what time of year you should plan to head out. So think about this for a second. Like, if you want to start in Georgia, then you should plan to head out in the late winter or early spring. And that'll help you avoid the heavy snows and those super cold temperatures that dominate the north at that time of year. Now, on the other hand, if you plan to strike out during the summer, you probably want to start up in Maine in order to dodge some of that southern heat that we experience here.
It's ridiculous that I hadn't even considered that. I am curious, though, like, do most hikers tend to hike in one direction over the other, or is it kind of evenly split?
You know, it's funny because I had never thought about this before, probably because of the region I've lived in all my life. But I always just in my mind assumed the only way you could possibly hike this was from south to north. And it's true. Like, there are definitely way more northbounders than there are southbounders. I think so. Southbounders make up just 10% of all the completed through hikes on record. Now, you compare that to 65% for northbounders. And then the others are segment hikers and those flip-floppers, of course. I just like saying flip-floppers.
So no matter which way you plan to go, prospective hikers should know that there are a lot of changes in elevation along the way. So this also sounds obvious. But because the trail more or less follows the spine of the Appalachian Mountains, you end up going up and down a whole lot. In fact, there's roughly 515,000 feet of climbing spread across the 2,200-mile trip. And that's actually the equivalent of climbing to the summit of Mount Everest over 17 times.
Whoa, I would be using that fact so much if I were to hike this. I do have to ask before I get to my next fact, do you think you'll ever hike the entire Appalachian Trail, even as a segment hiker?
No.
I don't even know why I asked that. There's no chance either one of us are ever going to do this, but it's fun to hike parts of it. Well, there's another word of warning for would-be hikers, and that's beware the Virginia Blues, because more than a quarter of the trail's length is in Virginia alone. And this is really hard to wrap my head around. More than a quarter of the trail is in the state of Virginia, which doesn't seem like that big of a trail, but some 544 miles of it are in the state of Virginia. So hikers cross into Virginia, and then it's a good long while before they'll see the state line of West Virginia. And that can make it feel like hikers aren't progressing, and a good many of them get so bored or frustrated that that stretch has become a notorious burnout zone.
So for the hikers who do manage to stay the course and make it to West Virginia, the AT has the headquarters located in Harper's Ferry. And any hikers who stop by there can get all they can drink cold water, internet access, and a chance to pamper their tired feet with these electric massagers. Hikers also get their picture taken and it gets added to the wall, you know, for all those people who are tough enough to make it to the not quite halfway point.
Yeah. All right. So this isn't exactly surprising advice, but you should probably wear shoes when you're on your hike. I'm giving some kind of a no-brainer advice today. But I say that because have you heard of the Barefoot Sisters?
I haven't.
Apparently, these two sisters from Maine traveled both ways on the AT. And for about two-thirds of their hike, they weren't wearing shoes.
I can't even imagine
that. It's just
that.
Bananas. But anyway, this is how they put it. We had decided to try hiking barefoot because it was the way we had always walked since we were kids. And in the mountains near our home or on the coast of Maine, we loved the connection to the ground that barefoot hiking gave us. Every surface felt different underfoot. Granite, shale, pine needles, thick mud, it felt good.
Which does have a certain romance to it, but it also sounds like they grew up feral.
It totally sounds like they grew up feral. None of those surfaces sound like things I want to walk on. This is all the more, I mean, maybe the mud that might feel kind of nice and squishy after a long walk, but still.
So I know you alluded to this in the intro, but I'm going to steal your thunder because I'm just fascinated by this fact. But did you know that June 21st is National Hike Naked Day?
I mean, not to be a wet blanket on this, but is this even legal, Mango?
So, yes and no. Nudity within national parks actually is legal, so long as you're not doing anything sexual. But forest and park rangers tend to discourage naked hiking in general because the risk of sunburn is so much greater without clothes.
God.
I mean, sunburn and other kinds of injury. But if you've ever wanted to hike the AT in the buff for some reason, then June 21st is your day to hit the trail.
And that would be my day to not be hiking on the Appalachian Trail. That is excellent advice, as usual, Mango. I mean, this is truly the kind of content that I think our listeners tune in for, which is why I'm going to hand you today's trophy.
Well, thank you so much, Will, and thanks so much for tuning in. Hey, if there are any listeners out there who've hiked the AT, we'd love to hear your stories. You can always send them in to parttimegenius@howstuffworks.com. And if you have time and want to write a review for the show, please do. Reviews help get the word out about our little show. From Gabe, Will, Tristan, and the rest of the gang here, thanks so much for listening.
Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Tristan McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Gary Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves.
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?